Hey friends, this is Michael Bohm with Youth Apologetics Training. Today we're going to have another special guest. We're going to be talking today with Dr. Charles Jackson. Dr. Charles Jackson has 4 degrees in science and education. He has a doctor of science education, a master's in environmental biology, master's in science education, and a bachelor's of science in biology. From 1980 to 2002, Dr. J taught secondary school sciences 11 years, then college biology and chemistry for 6 years, and then teacher education classes 6 years in Virginia. In 2003, Dr. Jackson founded Points of Origins Ministries and began teaching, speaking, and debating in creation science education. His emphasis has been in making the case for the literal interpretation of the scriptural accounts as being both scientifically and historically true, and indeed eminently superior in their accuracy compared to secular sources referencing the same topics. As a former youth pastor and school teacher, the work of Dr. J has been primarily focused towards Christian youth. Sounds like my kind of guy. Keenly interested in the liberation of Bible-believing college students from the delusion that their faith has been refuted by modern scientific understandings. Dr. J has crusaded against evolutionary dogma on college campuses across the mainland United States and also in Venezuela and Peru. He has presented creation science instruction to kindergartners, to church congregations and youth groups, to both secular and Christian high school and college faculties, to student assemblies from elementary through high school, and to Christian groups in many college campuses. He's also defeated many professors and grad students in debates on topics of the evolutionary dogma, all to the glory of God and to the truth of His Word. In fact, in the following interview with Dr. J, we do talk a little bit about some of these debates. You can find these debates online. If you search them out, just Google them. You'll definitely run into some of them. And Dr. J does a fantastic job. A few other things worth mentioning. He is listed in the Creation Science Hall of Fame. He's also part of Creation Truth Foundation. It's devoted to training disciples to trust the Bible's history for its accuracy so they will trust its promise for their destiny. He's also a life member of Mensa and Creation Research Society. Dr. J knows his stuff in the realm of creation and evolution. He's been a guest on many different creation-based podcasts. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Charles Jackson to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast.
Okay, yeah, I'm glad to be here.
So, friends, today we're going to talk about some of the things that we find in our high school, college level textbooks, our biology textbooks, all of our science textbooks that our kids in our public schools are reading. Some of these things, some of these evidences that are put out as fact for evidence for this theory of evolution have been proven long ago to be fallacious. So many things and so many other things that, well, perhaps there's some argumentation that needs to happen, but so many things that are being put forth in our textbooks that are just flat out wrong. And so today I've got Dr. Charles Jackson. We're going to talk about some of these things. So Dr. J, what are some things that we find in our biology textbooks in high school level, college level, that, well, are just flat out lies?
Well, there are things that have been used for generations now. And, for some reason, people just swallow them. And by people, I mean the textbook authors and the people who read the textbooks, the people who write new editions of textbooks, and the teachers, and then, of course, the students. There's so many different kinds of things. Let's see, the idea of the moths in England changing color, how the fossils are supposed to show that horses came from these little things that looked like Bambi, the idea that the human embryo goes through all these different phases from conception to birth that show the whole story of the evolution of us from worms and fish, the idea that the finches on the Galapagos Islands are showing evolution in just a few generations at a time, and that bacteria are evolving to be immune to our new medicines. All those things are totally not true. They're examples of either wishful thinking, or they're examples of something else that isn't evolution that's actually going on.
Okay, let's look at some of those. You mentioned the whole peppered moth fiasco. What happened there? Supposedly we have these pepper moths where, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm a little rusty on this one, but they used to be white, they'd land on these white trees, but then the Industrial Revolution happened, the trees started turning black from all the soot, and suddenly the white ones started dying off, and the black ones became the more dominant. And I know that at one point, for those pictures that we have in our textbooks, they actually glued those onto the tree, because they can only find two that were actually following that pattern.
Yeah, in 40 years, only twice have Bistan betularia, the peppered moth, been found to actually stand on the bark of the trees. These moths are smarter than the people who wrote the books, because they're not going to stand on the bark where a bird can see them and eat them. So they don't do that. So those were staged pictures. But what was being illustrated was not evolution at all. It was natural selection. And you said it yourself at first that these white moths were changing black, but then you pointed out really the white moths were dying off and the black moths became dominant. The real take-home lesson is before the Industrial Revolution and this event called Industrial Melanism occurred, there were black moths and white moths. And after the magic of evolution, there were white moths and black moths. You see, the only thing that changed was how many of each there were, and Darwin could be 100% wrong, and this would still happen just because the birds can now see the white moths on the dark bark, and those are the ones they eat. But there's no new genes, no new genetic information, no new traits at all, just a shift in the population of black moths compared to white moths in the same population of moths. And of course they'll say that's what the definition of evolution is, and if that's all evolution is, then I believe. But no, they're saying that crustaceans in the water evolved into moths, and this doesn't prove anything like that at all.
Okay. So it's natural selection doesn't create anything new. It only selects from the genetic information that's already there.
Yeah, even Stephen Jay Gould said that natural selection is not a creative force. It has to create, somehow, evolution has to create the fit so that the fittest can survive. Even Stephen Jay Gould understood this was a problem.
And see, when I was reading this in my biology textbooks when I was a kid, this was passed on to us as an evidence that evolution is happening, that these moths are actually evolving to look this other way. But what I'm understanding you saying is there's actually certain genetic, within their genetics, or their DNA, they have a certain range of variants where they're able to look like this or that, and we don't have a new insect here. It's still a moth.
Yeah, and it's not even a new color of moth, because both colors were flapping around in the trees together in the first place. You don't even have a new color. It's not even a new variety. The both varieties were living side by side before the time of Kettlewell's study and after Kettlewell's study. It's really natural selection, survival of the fittest, and there's no new thing that happened. Now, if you just want to say evolution means change, then yeah, there was a change in how many black moths there were after the tree bark darker, but there was no new thing. There were always black moths, just not as many of them.
Okay, so what does create new genetic information? We're taught in schools that it's mutation.
Well, mutation, you always hear creationists giving you the mathematical improbability of that, and we like to use a lot of math to show that the chances that a random accidental change in the base sequences of the DNA of some particular gene on some particular chromosome, we like to show that it's extremely low chance that that could ever happen, and actually an accidental change could make a beneficial change. So yeah, we can use a lot of math, but really, you don't have to go too much into the math. Everybody knows that a complex system that you do something to it by accident is almost a sure bet it's going to mess it up, and you know it's not going to make it better. I mean, just intuitively, everyone can see that. We can do the math. The fact of the matter is we've never seen a gene change by accident to make something better. There have been some changes in bacteria that haven't hurt them or that might actually make the gene do something a little different, but the bacteria just stay bacteria. They don't actually change into anything else, not by accident. Now, we can intelligently design their genes and make them change. We can't make them change into something besides a bacterium. We're not very good at this yet. But we, even when we change bacteria in their genes, it's intelligent design. We're just proving it can't happen by accident. Someone with intelligence has to make it happen on purpose.
Interesting. So they give us a lot of examples of beneficial mutations. What about sickle cell anemia?
Oh, I am horrified that I was speaking to the atheist club at Purdue University, and there was a nursing major in scrubs in the audience at the atheist club, and she went on and on about how sickle cell anemia is obviously an example of a good mutation. Well, it kills people. How could it be good? Well, if it's so good, why do we even treat people who have the condition and try to save their lives? We shouldn't interfere with evolution. We should let these people become super mutants like on the X-Men movies, you see.
Oh, boy. So is there any what other examples of beneficial mutations are given in our school textbooks?
Well, of course, sickle cell is given, but it's just a collateral damage sort of thing. That not only do your red blood cells not work very well and you're anemic and can die from this situation, and it's also very painful, but it also makes the shape of the blood cell, makes it harder for the malaria parasite to infect the cells, and so you're almost immune to malaria. So if the sickle cell doesn't kill you, the malaria can't, and they're saying now that evolution is giving us this wonderful gift of immunity to malaria, but that's ridiculous. It's like saying that you've cut off your arm to cure tennis elbow.
Your arm's off. No, it isn't. Look, just a flesh wound.
Oh my, you're a Monty Python fan.
You know what? This is the first time I've revealed that to my audience. You know, it's funny because once I got saved, I started watching these movies again. I'm thinking, man, there's a lot of blasphemy in these films. I never noticed that before, but anyway.
Well, once you're, you know, I mean, the Bible says that out of a good man's treasury bringeth forth good things, and out of the flesh can only beget flesh. And so, well, they're just giving us what they can. That's all they've really got. But yeah. Yeah, surprisingly, there was actually some good theology in Bruce Almighty. Evan Almighty was just a funny little joke, but Oh God movie, that was totally blasphemous, though, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yep. So,
Well, you asked about beneficial mutations. That sickle cell is one. They'll say things like anal lizards getting longer legs, and they'll say it's a mutation, but it's not. It's like the black moths. The black moths and the white moths, there was no mutation involved at all in that. That was ridiculous. They'll try to say examples of mutations like the beta-galactidase bacteria that Wall worked with, I think it was back in the 70s, and Kenneth Miller is fond of quoting this, that they destroyed the gene in a bacteria that allowed it to digest galactose sugar, and within three generations, the bacteria were digesting galactose sugar again, beta galactose, and they were generating the enzyme that was necessary, beta galactidase. Now, this was seen as us crippling the bacteria, and then they re-evolved the gene so they could survive. But the problem is, they never tell you the second half of that experiment. After they destroyed the gene in the bacteria, and then the bacteria began making beta-galactidase so they could digest galactose sugar again, they destroyed the gene again, the new gene, and then after 10,000 generations, they still had never created another gene to do it. So you see, maybe the system did have a backup in it. Maybe the genetics of the bacterium actually had another gene that could easily mutate or change, or it was another gene that could easily shift functions. But after the spare tire was gone, that's it, man. That's all she wrote. These bacteria never regained never had a third chance to regain that function again. And they don't mention that in the graduate level textbooks.
Okay, I'm going to stop right there, friends. Tomorrow we're going to pick right up where we left off here today. Hey, by the way, friends, if you like these types of podcasts, if you're new to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast, check out my podcast archive. If you go out to youthapologeticstraining.com, click on the podcast archive link, there you're going to find over 560 episodes, 570 episodes, and I'm adding to them every day. Check those out. They're all free. And they're all for you guys on topics like creation, evolution, cults, cult research, Bible contradictions, and many other topics around apologetics, worldviews. So yeah, check those out. And so tomorrow we'll pick up where we left off here today. And with that, I love you guys, and I'll see you tomorrow.